Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Leaders Toolbox here on Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews. I'm an editor here. And we are here, as always, with host Richard Gassaway. Chief, it's a new year. Hopefully it's going to be a very safe year. Hopefully the LODD numbers will go down significantly. But what are you going to be doing this year? I know you speak a lot. You're on the road an awful lot, different cities. And what are you looking at for 2008? Where can we see you?
Thanks, Pete. Before I get too much into what's coming up in 2008, thank the friends to the north, the Ontario Fire College, who had me up for a day to talk about leadership and fire ground command decision making. The hosts there were absolutely phenomenal hosts. I cannot say enough about how nice the fire college is in Ontario and how nice the people were. Very well attended conference, over 100 attendees. The facilities there are wonderful. They have dorms and dining halls and conference rooms, and it sits on a beautiful lake in Gravenhurst. It was just a wonderful day to spend with our friends from Canada. I also got a chance to go to Bellevue, Nebraska, and visit with their fire department to talk with them about fire department staffing issues and opportunities and how part-time people can be used to staff fire stations. It's a concept that we use here in Roseville, and had some contacts with Jeff Ricks, the assistant chief out there, and it's a program that they're looking to implement in Bellevue. Wish them a great deal of success in their efforts to start a staffing program. Bellevue is a city of about 48,000 people and continuing to grow, just neighboring to Omaha, and very progressive department, great people, really looking to move the department into a whole new era. So best of luck to my friends in Bellevue. Coming up in 08, a couple things locally here. I'm going to be doing a leadership program for White Bear Lake, Minnesota Fire Department, and it's an International Association of Fire Chiefs program. It's a program sponsored by Pierce Manufacturing. It's free for fire departments throughout the United States. Pierce Manufacturing pays for the cost of the instructors. The host department has a little bit of cost to share as far as a room for instructors. There's a cadre of about 15 different instructors that travel around the United States and teach this leadership program on behalf of the International Association of Fire Chiefs. I'm blessed to have one being offered here just close to home in my neighboring White Bear Lake. And we're going to be doing that program on January 12th and 13th. In February, I will be attending the National Firefighter Near Miss Reporting System Symposium in San Diego, and I'll be glad to look forward to reporting back to the listeners on the Leaders Toolbox about some of the things that are happening with changes and futures in the Near Miss Reporting System. And I'm very honored to be one of the invited attendees to participate in helping to figure out the future strategic direction of the near-miss reporting system, because I really believe that we can learn so much from the near-miss events that that people have and learn how not to make those same mistakes, so that, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, Pete, hopefully we have a reduction in the line of duty deaths. And I think the near-miss reporting system is certainly a significant tool to help lead to that. So looking forward to reporting back to you on that after I attend that in February.
Okay, great. Now, the Near Miss program has been a great friend of Firehouse. We've run a couple of webcasts with them, and the information that they provide is just amazing, because I don't think a lot of the firefighters take the time to really look and see, hey, has that happened before? You know, is this something that's an all-too-common occurrence? And once you get on that website, you can spend plenty of time looking around to see what similarities you've had with an incident that you've had happen in your own town. So they've got great info.
And John Tippett has done a tremendous job providing leadership to that program. He's such an enthusiastic, gung-ho person. They tapped the right person to help get that up and running and to see it through. And my hat's off to John and all the success of the near-miss reporting system.
I agree completely. Okay. All right, well, we'll look forward to seeing you at some of those events. And let's get into the show today. We've got a couple questions, and the first one is about the technology and email. It says, I've found on occasion that the intended message of my emails do not match what the person understood it to mean. I have found this happens most when I'm in a hurry and sometimes when I'm writing while I'm angry or frustrated. What are some things that I can do to help improve my email communication skills?
Yeah, when I read this email inquiry, I had the chuckle to myself because I think we've all been there. We've all sent or received emails and then said, gee, that was a mean-spirited email, or, you know, they could have said that nicer, or I don't even understand what they're trying to say here. And email is a wonderful thing and maybe at the same time a terrible curse that has been bestowed upon us, because it is much, much too easy to be calloused or either overly emotional or non-emotional when you're sending an email message, especially if you're angry about something or you're frustrated, to zip open the email box and type in the person's address and bang on your keyboard as you're saying, well, I'll show them and I'll reply back to them and I'll put them in their place. And the problem with email is, it's a permanent record, so anything that you put into email can be around for a long, 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 long time. And when you are mean-spirited in emails and you take shots at people, or you get into name-calling or just anything, what I'll say, less than totally professional communications, that document sticks around. I mean, you can have a one-on-one conversation with somebody, and there's no record of it that somebody's going to hold up to you later on and say, look at your behavior here. Look how you treated this person. So, be careful and remember that email is permanent. One of the things that I like to think about email is a very public record. As I type an email, would I be comfortable with that email being posted on the bulletin board in the fire station? Or would I be comfortable with that email being widely distributed to a broader audience? And I know sometimes there's confidential things in emails that you would say, no, there are some things I would not want to be circulated because they're confidential. So I'm not really addressing those things as much as I am our demeanor and our professionalism in our communication. I think it's important when you're sending email that is going to be a formal communication versus jaunting back and forth with a friend or a close associate, and what I call casual conversational email. That's not really what I'm referencing. I'm referencing more of the business oriented professional emails that we have the opportunity to send dozens and maybe for some people hundreds of them in a day or a week. Is to make sure that you use good grammar, good diction. Set it aside once you write it. Set it aside, come back, reread it. Most email has a draft box that you can store it in, especially if it's one where you're frustrated about something. For sure, when you type that, you're going to type that, and when you're done, you're going to say, okay, I feel better now that I've put them in their place. Well, before you hit the send button and you're feeling like you really put them in their place, put it in the draft box and come back to it a day later and open it up and look at it after you've allowed your emotions to settle down a little bit and say, would I be proud of myself if I sent this and behaved this way? I mean, I was really angry yesterday when I was typing this, and it felt really good to tell this person what I really thought of them and their ideas or whatever the challenges that you're having. But I would really discourage people from hitting the send button, and I think I'd rather say hit the save button, come back and visit it. I learned this years and years ago before email was ever even invented, and yes, I am that old. When I was taught in business communications class that when you prepare a letter, on a typewriter, on paper, and type it out, to set it aside and come back and visit it again and make sure that it has the right grammar and diction and the right tone and the right demeanor and what you're wanting to say is the message that's going to be read. And when you come back, and I do this a lot, and I know that I try really hard to get it right the first time, but I come back oftentimes and visit my emails and say, boy, I really said that in a confusing way, or I said that in a way that I think could have been softer or better intended, and often find myself making changes in how I type my email. Make sure that you use good grammar and diction. Use the spell check. It's really annoying, especially in a professional type business email, to get an email from somebody that has words that are misspelled. Be careful for autocorrect on spell check, because sometimes it can autocorrect it to a word that you didn't intend and completely change the meaning of something. Be careful of how you use words that can have some confusion, like if you want to say were and you type where, that can, again, leave your reader wondering, just how professional you are, because your written communications are not very professional. So take email for the serious type of communications that it is, especially even more than verbal, because it lasts forever. Don't assume that somebody reads your email and deletes it. Somebody may read your emails and save them for a very long time, and you want to have a good track record of being both courteous and professional in your email. And while we're at it, let's just talk about a few other types of email and communication related advice. When you type an email, put a subject line in the email. Give them a little bit of heads up about what it's about. And somebody who gets a lot of emails in a day, and I know many of you do get many, many dozens, hundreds of emails, having a subject line versus a blank allows you to quickly say, okay, this is what this is about. This is a priority. I'll read it now. Or I know what this is about, and it isn't a priority. I can set it aside. And having a subject line helps to work yourselves through the emails. Avoid those subject lines that are, kind of cutesy or not related to the topic. Try to be creative. Remember that most of the people that you're sending professional business email to are busy people, and they will appreciate not having their time wasted. Another thing that is, if somebody sends an email out to a group, so say, for example, I have a question, and I send an email out to a group of fire chiefs, and say you're among them, Pete, that I send this question out. Hey, have anyone ever come along this problem, because I'm having a problem in this particular area, and I need some help getting it fixed? And instead of sending a whole bunch of individual emails, I create a list and send it out to a group, because I want to get some advice, and maybe it's something timely I want to get some quick advice on. It's quite discourteous if you reply to my email to hit reply to all, because I have a question that I need some advice to, it doesn't mean that everybody on this email list has the same issue or the same problem or wants to read the advice that you have to offer to the person who asked the question. So when somebody sends out a group email asking a question, be courteous and only hit reply to the sender instead of reply to all. And imagine if you send it out to 20 people and then all 20 people hit reply to all, you're going to have a horrendous amount of email in your in basket, and all you did was receive an email from somebody else asking a question, and then pretty soon you got 20 emails in your basket for a problem that isn't even yours. So, be courteous out there when somebody sends out one of those group emails. And there's a lot of them that go out there, and that's a good way to get some good information fast. But when you reply, reply only to the sender. If you want to know everyone else's responses to that email, tell the sender when you reply, here's my reply, and oh, by the way, can you summarize all the replies into a single document and send it back to me? If that person's a professional person who put the question out, then they should be courteous enough to summarize all the answers into a single email and send it back out only to those who have asked to have that sent back out to them. This is a rather simple tip, but it really helps in people managing their emails, and emails are a huge, huge time consumer. I've heard people say, only check your email once a day or twice a day, and I've heard that advice. I'm not good at that. If I'm sitting at my desk and I get an email, it gives me a little sound on my computer, and I know I have an email, and you know, I'm usually quick to at least look at the email and see if it's something I need to respond to sooner or later. And then what I do is I create follow-up folders. I put the ones that aren't that critical into a follow-up folder. Just because someone sends me an email doesn't mean that I have an obligation to respond immediately back to it. You can set things aside and come back to those things days later, week later, and that's okay. You may have the person be impatient, but realize that you're in control of your time and not them. And simply because they sent you an email doesn't mean you have an obligation to immediately respond back to them. And while we're at it, I might as well just put a little plug in here for telephone etiquette. This was something that was taught to me quite a while ago by a boss that I used to have before I was in the fire service. And that is, and boy, I hope that every listener takes this piece of advice and uses it. When you call someone, anytime you call someone, the first thing you should say to that person is, "Did I catch you at a good time to talk on the phone?" Because what happens is, say I'm going to call you, Pete, and it's a convenient time for me because I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting around and I think, hey, that's a good time for me. I'll call Pete. I can talk for 20 minutes. And I call you, assuming, wrongly, that you are also sitting around doing nothing and you have 20 minutes to talk to me, which may not be the case at all. You may be very busy doing something very important, and I call you and I start right into my conversation without any concern or courtesy for what you happen to be doing at the time that I called. So my advice to listeners is, when you call someone, whether they're at home or at work, the very first thing you should say is, "Did I catch you at a good time to talk?" And if it's at work, you might say, "Did I catch you at a good time to talk for 20 minutes?" Because the person might be a good time for them to talk, but only for 5 minutes because they have to get to an appointment. They say, "Did I catch you at a good time to talk for 20 minutes?" No, you didn't. But if you call me back at 2:00, then I have that kind of time. Can we set up an agreement here that you'll call me back at 2? Here at my office? Yeah, okay, well then I'll have the time, and thank you for having the courtesy to make sure that I have the time available to talk with you. I know oftentimes I get people that call and jump right into something, and I'm thinking, man, I really just don't have the time to talk about this. I really wish they'd have asked, did I catch you at a good time? Or I might have somebody in my office and my phone rings, and I might be expecting an important call, and I say, "Excuse me, I'm expecting an important call," and I answer it, and it's not my important call. It's someone else, and I don't want to talk to them right now because I've got somebody that I'm talking to already, and they'll start right in, and then you feel embarrassed to have to interrupt them and say, "This isn't a good time for me to talk right now." Where we as the callers should extend the professional courtesy to everyone that we talk to when we call them and say, "Is this a good time?" Now, if you're calling a customer service line with customer service representatives there whose job it is to take your call and serve you, obviously you don't have to say, "Is this a good time?" because that's their job and that's what they're there to do. But I'm talking in general. When you call somebody, a professional associate or a friend, start the conversation out with, "Hey, did I catch you at a good time to have a conversation?" And I think that they'll appreciate it, and I think that you will have better success in having their undivided attention, because the last thing you want to do is catch them in the middle of something and only have them half listening to you because they were really busy when you called. So that's some email etiquette advice peppered in with a little bit of telephone etiquette advice for the listeners.
All right, Rich, that's some awfully good advice. I took some notes during this recording here, so hopefully next time I call you, I've learned my lesson.
Well, I didn't actually aim it at you, Pete, but if you called me and asked me if it was a good time, I know that I would certainly appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I've got that written down with a star next to it, so... Okay. Well, that's good advice not only for the fire officers, but everybody in general. We appreciate that, and we'll take a quick break here. This is the Leader's Toolbox on radio at firehouse.com, and if you have any questions or comments, please drop us an email to podcast@firehouse.com.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
welcome back to the Leaders Toolbox here on radio at firehouse.com. Chief, I have another question for you, and it has to do with leadership, so a good place for the Leaders Toolbox to offer some advice. In an effort to improve my leadership, I've been reading about various leadership styles. Recently, I got into an argument with my chief about what is the best style of leadership for the fire service. I say it's participative because that gets everyone involved. He says it's autocratic because we are a paramilitary organization and there can only be one person in charge. What are your thoughts about these two conflicting views of leadership style?
Well, I think starting out, I'd say that neither of these two people are going to always be right or always be wrong. I think before we get into what I think would be the best style for the fire service, let's talk a little bit about the styles that the writer had referenced. The first is the style he speaks of his chief, and that's autocratic leadership style. Autocratic being a single person's decision and management, very much a top-down, authoritative type leadership style where the boss tells the members what they want done, where, why, how they want it done, what they don't want done, and they don't ask for any advice from the members as to what they think the best way to do things, and are truly the boss and all of its meaning, a very authoritative my way or the highway type leadership style. So that's autocratic. The writer has made his argument that he thinks the best style is a participative leadership style. In that particular style, the leader would be one who would be inclusive of the members in the decision-making process and determining how things are done. He would, or she would, spend time asking for input from the members about the particular topic. What do you think? Gathering information. Realizing that the leader, in a participative style, the leader retains the right to make the final decision. So that authority stays with them, but the process along the way is they get a lot of people's input and a lot of different ideas on what it is that the decision is that needs to be made. And this can be a very effective way to motivate members when they feel as though they're having a say in things. Now, sometimes members think a say in things is the same as their vote in things. So, you have to be somewhat careful with participative leadership style insofar as making sure that members know that you're asking for their input and their ideas in an advisory capacity, but you as the chief are still going to be the one who ultimately has to make the decision. And sometimes those decisions are unpopular decisions, but you want to make sure that you get input from the members so that you're well-rounded in the perspectives when it comes time to make the decision. The third type, which isn't mentioned by the writer, but I'll still mention it, is one that's sometimes called free rein or laissez-faire management style. And this one is really where the leader is absolutely indifferent. They let people take problems in the organization and run with them, solve them themselves, are not really involved, don't really care about the good or the bad of a decision, as they divorce themselves from ownership of the problem and of the decision, and give away that decision-making authority to the members, whether it is right or whether the decision is wrong and whether it has good consequences or bad consequences. They completely just are totally hands-off from the decision. Now that we know about what all three are, the writer wants to know, well, which one is best? And there are probably listeners out there who have seen and experienced leaders who use all three styles. And my answer to which one is best, and this is probably going to leave some listeners frustrated, is it depends. You can't always have just one style and stick with that one style in every possible situation. So my advice is adopt what I will call, and many others have called, this isn't my term, a situational leadership style that says my style will vary depending on the situation that I find myself in. For example, you could say, well, a participative leadership style is a very good one where you elicit input from people and you hear what everyone has to say, both for an idea and against an idea. Where can you, how can that be wrong? Well, that can be wrong on a fireground incident when you're the incident commander and you don't have the time to gather everyone into a circle and say, okay, before we decide how we're going to fight this fire, I want to get input from everybody so I understand what everybody's thoughts and ideas are about how best to fight this fire. So if you take that participative style on the fire ground, you're going to burn a lot of buildings down. That isn't the right environment in which to have that kind of leadership style. So chances are you're going to be autocratic. You're going to listen to a few key advisors, gather your cues and clues about what's going on the fire ground, but then you're going to make a decision and say, ladies and gentlemen, this is the decision. This is the tactic that we're going to take. We're going to be offensive, defensive, marginal, aggressive, conservative, whatever term you want to put on it. The commander makes the decision, and the decision really isn't open for a whole lot of discussion or debate unless there's a serious safety concern with what that decision is. And then I think that somebody can raise their hand and say, oh, time out. You know, there's some serious safety issues here before we jump into this particular type of attack strategy. So the fire ground is a very autocratic leadership environment. And leaders in the fire service who were veterans of wars, World War II, and then came back and joined the fire service, or the Vietnam conflict, came back and joined the fire service, were very used to being led under autocratic leaders because the military is very order-driven, militaristic, decision-making, a very structured, very subordinate type of an environment. So when these people came back from military service and got into the fire service and assumed leadership roles, the very comfortable leadership role was autocratic leadership, because that's kind of what they grew up in and what they first learned as a leadership style. So in command and control environments, autocratic leadership is not only appropriate, but probably necessary. However, let's get off the fire ground and let's get back into the firehouse, and instead of dealing with firefighting and rescue scenarios, let's talk about operational and leadership scenarios in the firehouse and talk about whether autocratic style works in that environment. And to that end, I would say it doesn't work very well to be a autocratic, top-down, my way or the highway leader on administrative matters, but rather, when you're in the station-type environment, you don't have the time urgency that you have on an emergency scene. So you have a little more time and a little more opportunity to talk with people and to get their input and get their ideas and allow them to influence your decision-making. You know, I've been around the fire service for 30 years, so I already know what's best for this organization, and I know what's best for you based on my experience. That's a pretty dangerous, if not unmotivating, type of leader to work for, versus one who says, you know, I've been around for 30 years, but I'm still learning. There are a lot of things that I don't know and a lot of things that I can learn from my members. So I'm going to go out and ask them for their input and their ideas and try to understand their points of view on different problems that we're facing. One of the ways that I would demonstrate this by example is in my own department when it came time to purchase self-contained breathing apparatus. In my department, I'm predominantly an administrative chief, and that is to say I respond to fire incidents but serve in a capacity of a fireground incident commander and not as a firefighter. So consequently, I don't wear breathing apparatus. You know, my work environment is the command vehicle with a headset and a clipboard. So what role should I play in deciding what kind of breathing apparatus we should have? Well, there are chiefs out there who might be autocratic in their style that says, I know what kind of breathing apparatus is the best because I've worn breathing apparatus for, you know, for 30 years of my career. And in my style, in this particular scenario of participative leadership style, I took a hands, not a hands-off, but a delegated approach to deciding what kind of breathing apparatus we should have. So we formed a committee to evaluate the various breathing apparatus and allow them to have vendors come in and have the vendors demonstrate to the committee the kind of breathing apparatus, you know, the wares that they had. And then the committee then made recommendations to myself and my assistant chief about what they liked best in the breathing apparatus. And I didn't attend the meetings where the vendors were demoing their equipment, and I didn't veer from the recommendation of the committee. When the committee come back and said, we recommend this breathing apparatus, and I'd give them some parameters about how much money we had to spend and a few of the guiding principles toward the selection of our breathing apparatus. But in the end, they participated in a committee, they made a recommendation, and we purchased the breathing apparatus that they wanted to have. Well, how does that benefit our organization? Well, one, I, as the person who makes the ultimate decision, which, you know, in the participative management style, the ultimate decision maker does make the decision. They don't give up the right to do that. But my decision was based on the input of many people. There were a lot of fingerprints on this problem and on this process about what kind of breathing apparatus we were going to get. And in the end, I didn't feel comfortable being the one who decided what we were going to get when I don't wear air packs. So I let the committee and the membership through the committee participate in a process to make a recommendation about what kind of air pack we were going to get. And in the end, they said, well, we're recommending this particular brand of air pack. What do you think about that? And I said, well, if it's within the budget, I don't really have anything to say about it. I'm perfectly okay with whatever the committee recommends, because I really didn't have any foundation to disagree with what the hard work that the committee had done. And that's the air pack that we purchased. And I've done the same thing with turnout gear and the same thing with fire apparatus that we've purchased, is be very participative and get a lot of people involved, especially those who stand to gain or lose the most from the decision, and make sure they're involved. And you have to be, if you're going to be a good participative leader, you have to be well-rounded in the input that you get. In other words, if you say, I know person A, B, and C are going to like this change, so I'll go get their input. But I also know that person 1, 2, and 3 aren't going to like this change, so I'm not going to go talk to them. Well, that isn't fair. You know, you should get a well-rounded perspective on any particular issue or problem and talk to those that you know are both for it and against it. And as a chief or a leader, you'll find yourself making better decisions when you get participation from a well-rounded group of people, not just those who are yes people to whatever it is that you want to have, but get input from others as well who might have dissenting opinions. The third style is laissez-faire or free-reign type leadership. And this is where really the boss just doesn't care. They don't want to be involved. They are hands-off to the decisions. And they absolutely just give up the decision-making authority to other people. And when bad decisions are made, they're the first to blame, well, this wasn't my decision. That was so-and-so's decision. And that's really a poor leadership style. You know, as leaders, we have to step up and be responsible for everything that happens in our organization, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And when ugly decisions are being made, and we took a laissez-faire approach and said, you know, that wasn't my problem, it was somebody else's, and I had nothing to do with it, that's really a sign of a weak leader, and it's really going to affect the morale of the organization when they see the leader is not the kind of person who will take ownership for what's happening in the organization. Now, is there places and times for laissez-faire leadership? Absolutely there is. You think about fire departments that say you have a staffing program, whether you're you know, a career department or paid on call department, but let's just go for a moment, you have a staffing training program. If you have a good crew on duty in a station and they want to run their shift, you know, independently or autonomously, and you're comfortable with their skill levels and their knowledge and their ability to make good decisions, and they have a good boss on duty overseeing the crew, give them free rein. Let them run their shift the way they best see fit. Now, if you're not that comfortable with it, you might have to interject a little bit of a guidance and, you know, help frame for them certain expectations that you have. But if you've got good people, there is a place to be hands-off and to give them some opportunity to make some decisions and to make some mistakes and to learn from them. And that's really part of teaching others to become leaders, is to give them some latitude to make decisions. So there are times and places where laissez-faire can be beneficial, it can be motivational, and it can be very productive. I've often said, if I surround myself with the right people, the best thing that I can do as the chief is stay the heck out of their way and let them do what they know how to do and that they're very good at. And there are many, many opportunities in which to get out of their way and let them do what you know they can do and do a good job at it. So we've talked about the good and the bad of three different types of leadership style. Brings me back to the very beginning when I said, what style is best? It depends. As leaders, we have to, I think the best leaders adopt a situational leadership style where they say, I'm going to be either autocratic or participative or laissez-faire based on, one, how big the problem is, how urgent the problem is, how qualified the people are who are working for me who can help with input and solve the problem, and adopt the style that best fits the situation. But I don't think that any successful leader locks on to any one style and says, I will always and in all ways be autocratic, or I will always be a participative leader, or I will always be laissez-faire. I think the best leaders say, it depends on the situation. You give me the scenario with all the details, I'll tell you what kind of leadership style I'm going to use. But until I have all the details of the scenario and know about the players and how big the problem is and how important it is and how timely it is, I really can't tell you which kind of style I'm going to use. I'm going to use the one that best fits the situation that I have to deal with. And and as a good leader, you should be open with your people to say, there will be times when I will use all three of these different leadership styles, so that they're not confused and saying, well, Chief, sometimes you're autocratic and sometimes you're participative and sometimes you're laissez-faire. Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I'm all three of those. Hopefully not all three at the very same time, but I do take my turns with all types of leadership styles, because it depends on the situation and the people and the complexity of the problem as to which style is best for the problem. So I hope the listeners were able to glean some lessons about the three different kinds of styles and when it's best to use them. Thanks to that writer for that great question.
Okay, Rich. Again, wonderful advice to look at all three styles. And I guess you can almost relate it to a fireground incident. Like you said earlier, you choose a style based upon the situation that you're confronted with and choose the best style to get the best outcome. So.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, again, Chief, thank you very much. This is the Leader's Toolbox here on Radio at Firehouse.com. Host is Richard Gassaway. If you have any questions for Chief Gassaway, please send an email to podcast@firehouse.com. And we'll see everybody again next month here on Radio at Firehouse.
Okay. Thanks to the listeners, and Happy New Year, everyone.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.